Thank you everyone for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here. So today's lecture is going to be about generative modeling. So before getting started, what I'd like to mention is that if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me. I'll be happy to answer your questions. And it's about discussion, like if something is not clear yet, please feel free to interrupt me. So before go into the core like topic of this presentation, I would like first to give you like a brief review of what we did throughout this course. So as you saw with Lauren, like in the first part of this course, we learned about supervised learning, where we have some data set and with some inputs and labels, they want to learn a function that fits the inputs to the labels. So we saw like several techniques in machine learning to do that. So we saw started with linear regression, and then we moved to feedforward neural networks. And then later on, when we want to process like topological data, we use the convolutional neural network. The other section in this course is about unsupervised learning. So you saw how to do PCA or principal component analysis. You also saw how to do TSNE. Okay, in this lecture, we're gonna do another branch of unsupervised learning, which is about generative modeling, okay? So the outline of this lecture will be first, we'll give you a brief motivation for generative modeling. And then in the second section of this lecture, we're going to see an important principle that allows us to optimize models so that they can generate some new data. So we're going to see the maximum likelihood principle and DKL divergence. And then in the last part of this lecture, hopefully we're going to see some classification of generative models. Okay, so there are three main branches of these models. So there's the So we're going to see them later. So the first is called exact likelihood models. The second one is about approximate likelihood models. And then the last one are called implicit likelihood models. So it's going to become clearer as we go on into the lecture, okay? So let's get started first with a motivation to generative model. So what I wanted first to do is just to show you examples for how machine learning can generate some new data by using some training data, okay? So the first example is ability for neural networks or generative models to generate music. So here I have a recording for, so there's like a company called AVA, which stands for the Artificial Intelligence Virtual Artist. So this company like uses tools from deep learning to generate some new classical music. I just want to show you like a sample just for you to appreciate how good these generative models can be. So I think I have to share the sound as well. Let me just do that here and then play the recording. Oh, I just want to say, can you hear something like when I did the recording? Okay, good. Okay, so let me play it again. Okay, yeah, I would like to continue, but yeah. So as you can see over here, like, yeah, so the quality of the classical music is very good as from what you've heard. So also another application like where generative models can be applied is generating pictures. So there's a website called This Person Does Not Exist. So there, what's behind is that they use a generative model to generate pictures of people that do not exist. So this is a picture of someone who does not exist. So if you want, you can go to this website. And each time you go, you'll see a new picture of someone who does not exist, okay? So this is basically an application of these generative models. Another application that was inspired from Lauren's lectures previous years is about you like generating some new images by taking by using some personal like some customized style. So there is a website called DeepArt, and what we can do is we can upload a picture. So here you can upload a picture Perimeter Institute, and then we can choose some style, and then the generative model will output a new picture or the picture of PI with this new style. Okay, so this is also some other application of these generative models. We can also do the same thing for pictures. As you can see over here, we can take this picture and the style, and then we can generate some new picture with this style. And it's also interesting that these generative models can also generate some text data. So what I did is I went to this website, which is a generative model for generating text. And what I tried to do is like I typed machine learning for many body physics, and then I asked this generative model to continue. So what's the output is the following. So it said the machine learning course is a great way to learn about machine learning without having to learn a lot of math. It covers the basics of machine learning. It's a great way to get started with machine learning. The course has a lot of videos you can watch on your own time. You can also download the course material to work through the material at your own pace. So it looks like it's something very coherent, at least, yeah. If this neural network was not aware of what's going on in this course and gives us some idea, like a very coherent text about what's going on. Okay. So after this motivation, the main goal of generative modeling, as you saw, is to take some training data from some unknown distribution, which we can call P data, okay? And then we want to have a model with some probability P, we can call P model, and we want to this probability to be as close as possible to the probability of the data, okay? So to give you an idea about that, what we do is we have some data set, which we can call D train, okay? So that's our training data set. And this training data set is sampled from this probability that we don't know. So in real life, we don't have access to this P data. So this is something we don't know, but we have access to the observations or the samples from these unknown distribution, okay? So we use these observations or this training data, we feed it into the model, and then we use some training procedure that we can clarify later, depending on the types of the models. And then at the end of this training procedure, we expect that the probability of the model will be closer as possible to the probability of the data. And then we use this probability of the model to sample some new data points, okay, from that are hopefully different from the training data, okay? Okay, so this is what you've seen in these examples. So for instance, in this example, the neural net, like the generative model was trained on some classical music and managed to generate some new classical music out of that. Okay, so this is the idea. So let's say you have inputs that have two components, X1 and X2. So the training data are the black dots over here. Hopefully, if we train a generative model, it will help us to generate some new data that are closer to the training data. Okay, so hopefully we will not get some generated data that's very far from the training data, but hopefully inside or closer to the training data. Okay. So this is the goal of generative model. Like, is there any questions so far? Is everything clear?
So what we are assuming in this is that there is some probability distribution. We don't know from which the training samples come from. And we are trying to, whatever the new data points we predict will be, means we are, the claim is that that will be also drawn from something similar.
Exactly. That's the aim of what we are going to do today. Okay.
So translating it to, say, generating a picture.
Yes.
So the idea would be like the photo of PI and then the other photo, other picture where there was. So it's how do you map the probability distribution to pictures like this?
That's a very good point. So this example is a bit more complicated. Like what I can do, for instance, is take the example of like this is simpler. So let's say generating of people who do not exist. So what we can do, say for instance, that the probability of faces, so it can take some input x. So this x is the image. So each x will be an image. So we feed in all the pixels, and this probability will give us some probability. Okay. And then the goal will be to learn this probability, and then we sample from it to generate some new faces. Okay. Yeah. Does that clarify a bit?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So the same thing for the other examples in text data, we can also like translate the text into a vector, and then we can generate some new data out of that. Okay. So now after having seen that, let's go to an interesting principle that allows us to train generative models, which is called the maximum likelihood principle. Okay, so as we've seen before, in the motivation, our aim is to find the best models data given some data set. Okay, which means that we want to maximize the probability of the parameters given the data set. Okay, so this is the aim. So since we want, we have some data set, we want to obtain the best parameters that explains our data set. Okay, meaning that this probability P of theta given D should be very high. Okay, is this clear? Okay, so in order to be able to see how we can maximize this probability, what we can do is use Bayes rule, which says that we can flip the dependencies. So the probability of theta given the data set would be the probability of the data set given the parameters times the probability of the data of the parameters over the probability of the data set. Okay. So each term here has a name in the context of machine learning. So, or in the context of probability theory. So this term is called a prior. So that's the prior knowledge we have about the parameters. This term is called the likelihood. This term is called the evidence, and this term is called the posterior. Okay. So
it's kind of like hypothesis.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So the prior is a hypothesis we make initially. So we have some hypothesis, and then we have some likelihood that updates this hypothesis to obtain a posterior, to obtain some updated knowledge. Okay. Seems like you see the idea. Okay, so we usually like what we have is that we don't know anything about the parameters data. So we can assume that we have a uniform prior, meaning that all the parameters are equally probable. Okay. So this means that P theta is a constant term, so it doesn't depend on the parameters. So in this case, since also this term is also a constant. This is a constant, then maximizing this term will be exactly same as maximizing the likelihood. Okay. So this is what we're doing over here. So maximizing, so the maximum, the parameters that maximizes the posterior will be exactly the parameters that maximizes the likelihood. Okay. And hence, this is the maximum likelihood principle. We want to maximize the likelihood so that we can get the best parameters that explains our data sets. Okay.
Do we have an interesting part, the evidence term? Because like right now I can picture having, let's say, relative probabilities, you know, like given this hypothesis, you know, does it or does it not explain the actual data? the problem. So what starting point for P in a concrete example?
Oh, can you say that again? What is the starting point of?
Of P.
Oh, so the P. So you mean this hypothesis over here?
You can take the first D to the sum of P of D given theta times D of theta.
For all, yeah.
For all, over all theta. Mm-hmm. That's how you calculate P of D.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can repeat it again, because I couldn't hear you very well. That's the reason. Yeah. So you meant like, what's the form, like how we can, like, why did you choose this uniform distribution? Was that the question or was it something else?
Yeah. Okay. Actually, that's
the
P of D, right? Yeah.
P of D. So you mean like what is the expression of P of D, right? Or how we can get it?
After, because right now for me it was just funny, like the probability of a certain, you know, evidence, because you could also, I guess, in a different approach, just say, well, the evidence is just there, it doesn't have a probability, you know, but we're trying to
look. So your question is about like why we call it the evidence, why, so it's a probability but it's an evidence, so it should not be a probability, is that what you meant? Yeah
I think that was kind of
So this is just a name. I think this name is a bit confusing, but what I wanted to focus on here is that this is a constant, so it does not depend on the parameters data. Okay, so it's just a probability that should be there, but it does not matter, does not affect this equality over here. Okay, so is this clear for you, for everyone? Okay. So the good thing about this is that the likelihood is more accessible to compute. Okay. So because let's say we have a Gaussian model or Gaussian distribution. So given like the mean mu and the variance sigma squared, we can compute the probability of some data point. So we can just plug in the value of x to this expression, and then we can get some probability, okay? Whereas the inverse is not obvious to obtain. So that's why we use the maximum likelihood. So the same thing if we have another more complicated model, let's say like multivariate Gaussian distribution, we can do the same thing. And we're gonna see later on how we can do this for the generative models based on neural networks in this lecture. Okay, so now the aim is to maximize the likelihood. So what is the exact expression of the likelihood if we have some data set D? So the expression of the likelihood is given, I'm going to denote it by the following. So we're going to call it L theta D. So that's P of the probability of the data set given the parameters. So the data set is formed out of data points. So we have multiple vectors, x1, x2, until xm, so m is the number of data points given the parameters. Okay, so now we can assume that the parameter, like the data points, are independent. So because of this, we can factorize this likelihood into products of probabilities. Okay, so we're going to have this term times this term until we arrive at this term. Okay. Sounds good so far? Okay, so now the issue, what's gonna happen is that if we multiply a lot of probabilities together, this term can be very small, okay? So the issue is that we can get a very small number out of this multiplication, so it will be hard to handle this numerically, okay? Especially if there are a lot of data. So typically if there are millions of data points, multiplying million probabilities will definitely result in a very small number. So what we do instead is we take the negative of the log of the likelihood. So in machine learning, they call this negative log likelihood, or they denote it as NLL. And then if we do this, you can see that the products will become a sum. So we're going to have minus the sum from i 1 to m of the log of each of the likelihoods of each of the data points, okay? So this is much simpler or like much more convenient to work with numerically, especially if we want to do gradient descents and to we want to update the parameters, okay? So now the question is why we can use the negative likelihood as a cost function. Is there some other motivation besides numerical convenience? Okay, and this is where we're going to define the callback labeler or KL divergence. Okay, so the KL divergence is a measure that takes two probability distributions. So let's say we have the probability of the data and the probability of the parameters. How it's defined is as the follows. We sum over all the possible x over here, and then we take the probability of the data of x, and then we take the log of the ratio of p data over p of data of the same data point. Okay, and this is how it's explained. So the property of this measure is that the KL of two probability distributions p and q is always positive. Okay, so you can show that using Jensen inequality. And the other property that's very interesting is that the KL of two probability distributions is zero if and only if these probability distributions are equal. Okay, so somehow, so it makes sense that we can use the KL divergence as a cost function, because the closer these properties are together, the better the smaller this KL will be. Okay. So now let's see what's the relationship between KL and the negative log likelihood. So if we decompose the expression of the KL, first we're going to have the first term made of the p data and the log p data over here. So this is the first term. Okay. And then the second term is made out of this term and this term. We're going to have a minus sign over here. Okay, so this is the second term. Sounds good? And then what you can see is that this expression does not depend on the parameters data, okay? So, and you can notice that this expression is equal to the opposite of the entropy, okay? So this has the same expression as the Shannon entropy, and it's called the entropy of the data. So that's a constant term. So let them denote here as C. And then what we can do is that we can approximate this sum. So we're summing over all the possible pictures or let's say data points. And what we can do is we can do important sampling. So we can just pick the observations to compute an approximation of this term. So as you might have seen before, like if we have some probability distributions, if we have observations, we can use important sampling to approximate sums like these into these over here. Okay, so if you have a data set with m data points, this expression will be approximately this one, given that m is large enough. Okay, so is this clear so far?
This approximation, what is the motivation? Why?
Okay, yeah. So
you are setting uniform distribution for data or something like that.
Look, have you seen before important sampling in Monte Carlo? Was this something you've seen? Okay, maybe I can do a quick review about that. Okay. Or quick a definition of that. So let's say we have a sum. We have some observable, and we have this observable is equal to the sum over all the, let's say we have spin configurations. So this observable will be equal to the value of this observable at this spin configuration times the probability of this spin configuration, okay? So if we have a spin configuration, so the summing over all these configurations will be very hard, since if we have, for instance, a configuration of spins that has length n, this sum will have 2 to the n possibilities. Okay? So it will be exponentially expensive to do that. Okay? So one way to go around that is by taking samples. So let's say we have samples. We have m samples that are drawn from this probability p, okay? Meaning that we take the samples that have the highest weights in p, okay? So we know that these are the ones that will contribute the most to this sum. So we can approximate. So important sampling allows us to provide an approximation to this sum, to these types of sums. So we're going to have the sum from I to m of O of sigma I. And then we divide by m. Okay, so it will be the average of these observations. Okay. So this is so important sampling like allows us to approximate these type of expensive sums into sums that we can manage if we have a large enough number of data points.
But okay. how do we choose these m points?
How to choose these data points?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so for instance, if we have, let's say, a coin, it has a probability distribution. What we can do is just sample. You can flip the coin and gather the observations, okay? And so if we have...
These are just any m observations.
Yeah, so we just gather m observations. So if we have pictures, we gather m pictures. Okay. And then those will be the ones that have the highest probabilities or... Because you expect that the observations that come out are actually the ones that have the highest weights. Okay, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's just like if you know the theoretical probability, you do use that formula. If you don't know, you do those experiments m times.
Exactly.
In the limit getting to infinity, it will reach there. Okay, that makes sense.
Exactly, yeah. Also, sometimes even if you know the exact expression of p theoretically, it will be still hard to compute the sum, okay? So we still need to do this sampling because it's hard to do. If it's not possible to calculate the sum exactly, then we need to do that, okay? Okay, cool. So also something I want to note as well is that here I use this expression for p theta of x. So this exactly is the same as the likelihood. So this is p of x given theta, okay? So you just give it a different notation. So if you look carefully here, this is exactly the same as the negative log likelihood, okay? With just a term m over here, so constants. So this means that minimizing the KL divergence is the same as minimizing the negative log likelihood, which is equivalent to maximizing the likelihood. Since the log function is an increasing function with a negative over here, so minimizing will be exactly the same as maximizing the likelihood. Okay? Sounds good so far? So this is, we're gonna rely on this principle. We're gonna minimize the negative log likelihood, okay? Whenever it's possible. Sounds good? Okay, cool. So now let's move on to the third section of this lecture, which I'm going to provide you with some classification of or examples of generative models that exist in the literature. So the first classification of models is those that are called exact likelihood models. So those are the models where the likelihood can be computed exactly. So those are the ones that we have a theoretical expression of the likelihood, okay? So an example of these are called, one example are called autoregressive models. So those are closely related to the research I'm doing in my PhD. So in the next lecture, I'm going to show you like an example of these autoregressive models, which are recurrent neural networks. I'm just going to give you a brief overview about those. So these autoregressive models are mostly suitable for discrete data. Okay, so if you have pixels, pictures, so it can take discrete values. If you have spin configurations, they can take discrete values and so on and so forth. So these autoregressive models are based on what's called the probability chain rule. So you know, in probability theory, we can decompose a joint probability. So this probability PD of X is PD of X1, X2, until the nth components of this vector. Okay, so this is called a joint probability. And then we can factorize it into a product of conditional probabilities. So this expression is exact. So we can have the probability of the first component, then the probability of the second component given the first component, and then the probability of the third component given the second and the first. And then at the end, we can have the probability of the nth component given all the previous components, okay? So here, let's say the PD is the probability of the data. What we want is to find some model P of theta. And we can do the same thing for this probability of the model. We can decompose it into products of conditionals. And then what we want is we want each of these conditional probabilities to be as close as possible to these conditional probabilities that are obtained from the probability of the data. Okay. So this is the aim. So instead of approximating the whole joint distribution, we approximate only the conditionals. Okay. Sounds good. So the advantage of this approach is that we can generate the components sequentially. So let me show you a picture so that you can see the idea. So let's say we have some autoregressive model. So that's a black box. I don't want to explain the details, but examples of these black boxes are recurrent neural networks that we're going to see in the next lecture. There are also some other models called pixel C convolutional neural networks. There are also models called transformers, so on and so forth. So let's assume that we have a black box, okay, that initially takes some vector. So let's say here we have some x0. It's a null vector. We just initialize this model. And then it outputs this probability that I've told you here. It outputs some probability. So initially, so if we feed in x0, we're going to get the probability of x1. Okay. So in general, we have this expression at the ith step. So at step zero, we have the following. What we can do later, and then we can sample from this probability. So this probability will have some components. So for instance, if we are dealing with, let's say, text, the size of this vector will be the size of the dictionary of words. We'll have thousands, even millions of words. If we're dealing with pixels, then the size of this vector will be, for instance, if we have RGB, we're gonna have 256 times three. And then if we have only, like we say, spin configurations, then we can only have two, either up and down. So we get this size of this vector will be two. Okay. So this vector will be basically like a multidimensional coin that we flip. So you flip this multidimensional coin, and then we get the first, let's say, the first component x1. So the ith step will be xi. And then we feed it again to the autoregressive model. And then it allows us to compute the next conditional probability. And then we feed that, we obtain the next sample, and then we do this again and again until we get the full spin configuration. So we first sample from this, and then we get the second sample, the second component from this, and then this third one until we get the last one. Sorry, it's from P theta. So we do this first sampling here, second sampling here, until we arrive at the last component. And by gathering x1, x2, and xn until xn, we can get an observation or like a data points x. Okay. Is the idea clear so far? Okay, so in the next lecture, I'm going to show you the details of how this black box looks like. Okay, I just want you to see that how these models work in like in with a high level idea.
Amanda, just a question here.
Yes.
You're saying right now that this model is trained, right? From a trained model.
Exactly. Yeah. So here, like, I'm assuming that these models are well trained. So, so in order to train them, we use this principle that I've mentioned. So we can either use the negative log likelihood that we can compute by, so for instance, if we multiply these conditionals, we can compute this probability over the likelihoods. And then we can take the negative of the log to compute the negative log likelihood, and then we can do gradient descent to optimize these models. So if we are well trained well enough, we're gonna get some good samples that are closer to the training data. Okay, well, does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So just to be clear, you're not really using this this whole procedure is using the.
So here we assume that we don't know. So having the access of this P data is something we don't know. So we just assume that we can factorize it, okay? And then each of these will hopefully be closer to these conditionals after minimizing the negative log likelihood. Okay. So if we approximate, if the model is trained well enough, then the P of theta will be closer to P of the data, even if we don't know what's the expression of this P data. We only have if we have access to the data set.
But how do we check that it's close to PD if we don't know PD?
Yeah, so that's the motivation behind this discussion here. So we said that if we minimize the negative log likelihood, then the KL divergence will be also minimal. And we know that the minimum of the KL is something that's expected to be close to zero. And when it's close to zero, then the probabilities will be also closer to each other. So that's the hope. Go ahead.
But to compute that, we need P.
Yes. So that's a good point. So to compute the negative log likelihood, we don't need the probability of the data point, the data set, right? But we're implicitly using this probability to compute it, okay? So we're kind of using important sampling to avoid the use of the computation of the probability of the data set, okay? So even if you don't have access, for instance, to this term, this constant term, by using this observation that minimizing the negative log likelihood, we're actually minimizing the KL divergence, even if we don't have access to the probability of the data. Okay. So with this observation, we can know that if the gradient descent work well until we get some good conversions to a global minimum, we're hopefully closer to the probability of P of the data will be closer to the probability of the data. Okay.
And so effectively, you won't be looking for a KL equals zero, but instead the negative log likelihood being equal to some constant that you don't know before, but it will just converge to this.
Exactly converge to this constant minus C. Okay. So we expect at the end at convergence will be minus C, so that C minus C will cancel each other. Okay. So hopefully it converges to some constants. And we don't know what's exactly this constant, but we aim that this constant will be exactly this one over here, so that the KL is zero. Okay. Does that answer your question? Okay. So this was about ultra-aggressive models. So again, as I've told you, in the next lecture, you're going to see more details about an example of these autoregressive models, the recurrent neural network over here. Now, I want to go to another example of exact likelihood models where the likelihood can be computed exactly. And those are called normalizing flows. So these models are mostly suitable for continuous data. Okay, so meaning like, let's say we have coordinates of molecules or some other type of continuous data. What the aim of these models is to say, if we start from some simple distribution, let's say Gaussian distribution, what these models do is that they do a coordinate transformation. So we apply some function g on top of this initial variable z, so that we can obtain some probability x. And then we end up with some new probability distribution p of x with more complicated pattern. So the aim is to have a complicated enough function g so that we have a complicated enough p of x to approximate some, hopefully approximate some data distribution, some probability of the data distribution. Okay. So the way we can do that is first to note that if we have some coordinate transformation, so we want to know how the expression of Q of Z and the P of X relate to each other. And to do that, let's just know that if we have some continuous probability distribution, then it's going to be normalized to one. So it means that if we do the integral, we're going to have one, okay? So now if we have a coordinate transformation, then x here is equal to g of z, meaning that z will be equal to g minus one of x. Okay, so here we assume that g is a bijective function. Okay, so that's a requirement over here. So what we can note as well is that this measure dz will be equal to this partial derivative, or if let's say for now you're going to be the total derivative of z with respect to x times dx. Okay, so if we look carefully here, the p of x will have exactly this expression. Okay, so then we'll end up with the following one. So p of x will be equal to q of g minus one x, or q of z, times the absolute value of the derivative of z with respect to x, okay? So now the reason why I denoted this as a partial derivative is that if we have multi variables, then instead of having like only a partial derivative over here, one partial derivative, we're gonna instead end up with something else. So yeah, does anyone have an idea about how this will transform if we have multivariables?
So the Jacobian.
Exactly, yeah. So we're gonna use a Jacobian. So basically here we're gonna take the determinant of the Jacobian and we're gonna take the absolute value, okay? So the probability of X will be equal to the probability of Q of Z. So that's, again, so just to remind you, we'll have a simpler expression. Let's say each variable will have a Gaussian distribution. And then we're gonna need to multiply that with the determinant of the Jacobian, okay? So now the requirements in the function G in these normalizing flows is that it has to be chosen carefully so that we can calculate this determinant of the Jacobian exactly, okay? So we don't want, or more efficiently, we don't want a function such that it will take us a lot of time to compute this Jacobian. And an interesting idea would be to take this function g, or in such a way that this derivative of g minus one of x, so g minus one of x is exactly z. So this Jacobian, so we want this Jacobian to be like a triangular, okay? So you know, like when a matrix is triangular, the determinant is basically the products of the diagonals, okay? So that's the idea. We want this function in such a way that the Jacobian is a either upper diagonal or upper triangular or lower triangular, okay? So this will allow us to compute the determinants very efficiently without having to take into account all the components of the Jacobian. So a simple example of that is if we do like a simple, so let's say we have two variables, x, z1, Z2, and want to transform them into X1 and X2. We can do a very simple transformation. We can say X1 is exactly Z1, and then X2 will be Z2 times the exponential of some function of Z1 plus some additive constants T that is a function of Z1, okay? And then if we want to invert that, we want to include G minus, so this mapping, so going this way is G, and going the other way from Z to X will be G minus one. So if you want to compute the inverse function, then Z1 will be exactly X1, and then Z2 will be X2 minus T of X1, okay? And then here we're going to have the exponential of minus s of x1, okay? So after having computed the inverse function, then the determinant will be exactly, so in this case, will be a diagonal. So here we're going to have determinant of 1 and exponential of minus s, and the determinant is simple to compute, okay? So obviously this example is very simple, but what the idea will be to generalize this to a lot of variables. Let's say we have n variables. So we're going to have like a, we're going to have a transformation that's more complicated. And also the idea will be to iterate these transformations. So instead of applying this function, let's say f once, we can apply different, we can iterate over a lot of these transformations. We can apply some function f, l, and then another function, other functions over here until we arrive at other functions. So if we gather a lot of these transformations, then hopefully this coordinate transformation will be complicated enough so that we can have this landscape, as you can see over here, okay? So this is the idea of these normalized forms. We first have these invertible transformations. And so that allows us to compute the Jacobian efficiently, the determinant of the Jacobian efficiently, and then we iterate over the, over these transformations to have a very good coordinate transformation. And what I wanted to note as well is that these, so these parameters or these functions S, T, so all the parameters that are used in these functions are actually parts of the parameters. So these are learnable parameters. So we can train them to maximize the negative or to minimize the negative like log likelihood until we arrive at a coordinate transformation that allows us to provide a good approximation. Okay. Is it clear so far about normalizing flows?
Why is it called normalizing?
That's a very good question. So I think the idea, so the intuition I have is that since, so since like here, we're mapping a probability distribution to another probability distribution, so we're keeping the normalization. So that I think might be the reason why it's called normalizing in flows is by because we flow in, we have a flow from one probability distribution to another one, but I might be wrong, yeah. It could be because of another reason, but I think that's the intuition I have. Yeah. 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 Is that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I suppose.
Okay. So now let's move on to another type of like likelihood of generative models. So that's the approximate likelihood models. So this is when the likelihood is intractable to compute. So an example of these are like energy-based models. So a prominent example is what's called the restricted Boltzmann machines, known also as RBMs. So here what we have is an energy that depends on some, on the, so on the vectors X. So those are, could be for instance, pictures or spin configurations or text data. And we also have some hidden vectors. So those are vectors that allows us to map, to introduce correlations between the components of the vector X. And the expression of this energy function is has the following expression. So in the first term, we connect the components of X to the components of H. So here the size of X is, so X has size N and H has size, let's say M. And then, so M here is a hyperparameter. It can be as large as we want. So the first sum connects X and H. And then we have a term that only depends, that only connects, it's a term that does not depend, does not connect the H in the X, okay? So what happens here is that what we do exactly is that we take the probability of X and H, so that's a joint probability of X and H. It's exactly equal to the exponential of minus this energy term. So that's why it's called energy-based model. So it's very similar to the Boltzmann probability. So we take the exponential of minus the energy function over the partition function. So the partition function Z is equal to the sum over all the possible x's and all the possible h's of the exponential of minus this energy function, okay? And what I wanted to note as well is that these W, so these weight matrices and these parameters are actually the parameters of these RBM. So those are the parameters that we try to learn. And if you want to compute, for instance, the likelihood or the probability of some data point, then what we need to do is to do the marginalization. We need to sum over all the H's. So this is what we do here. We sum over all the H's. And then we're going to get this expression in addition to the normalization. Okay. So what's going to happen is that the computation of this expression is exact, whereas if we want to compute the partition function, that will be something intractable. Okay, so that will be that's the reason why this is an intractable model. Okay, so to see how we can compute this term exactly, or the numerator over here, let's take the expression of the energy. So if we take the expression, so we're going to have these three terms. So the first term, so this term over here does not depend on H. So we can take it out of the sum. So if we take it out with an exponential, it will be a multiplicative factor in the sum. So we can take it out of the sum, and then we're gonna get the sum over the components. So let's say the vectors H's can be either plus or minus one, where the components of the vector A's can be either plus or minus one. Then if we have M components, then we're going to have M sum. And then for each of, we can decompose these terms into products of exponential, like into M term. And because of the exponential, we're going to have the products of M term. And because of the fact that these are independent from each other, then the sum of the products will be the products of the sum, okay? By moving from here to here. And then I'm going over the high level details. You don't need to understand the technical details, but I just want to show you that if we do these manipulations at the end, we can arrive at an exact expression, okay? So what we have here is we have the exponential of this term times the product from I to from one to M of this term, which is a hyperbolic cosine of this expression. Okay, so that's an exact expression for the numerator. But for the denominator, so the partition function, that's actually a sum over the numerator. So we need to sum over all the possible components x to obtain the partition function. But that's something intractable because we have this hyperbolic cosine function that does not allow us to do further algebraic manipulations, okay? So in the literature, there is an approximation that allows us to compute an estimate for this partition function that's called a contrastive divergence. So I'm not going to go into details, but just to show, wanted to mention that there is a way to do this approximation, okay? And one way to to sample or to get observations out of this P of X, even if we don't know what's exactly, is by using important sampling. Okay, so that's what we do. For instance, if we have a Boltzmann probability, we use Metropolis sampling to get samples. Same thing here, we can use Metropolis sampling to get observations or like data points out of this P of X over here. Okay, so this is the way we can do generative modeling. Instead of having the exact expression, we can get the samples by using a procedure like Metropolis sampling to out of this probability that we don't know exactly. Okay.
Just a question here. I know you're just giving an overview, so I don't know if it's possible to summarize this question, but so the X variables here, this would be your data for
exactly
just your data. And I know the W, you've said, I think the W's and the V's are parameters that we're trying to learn. Could you maybe just say a little bit more about the H variables?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Yeah, so the H variables are actually the ones that are actually just hidden variables that allows to introduce correlation. So there's a comment they forgot to mention. So is that if we sum over the H's, we're actually introducing correlations between the X variables. So let's say here, so if you look at this energy function where each X is connected to all the H's, so for instance, if we sum over this variable, then we're going to introduce a connection between, let's say, x1 and x4. Okay, so this is how this looks like. So the same thing, if we sum over this variable, we're going to introduce another correlation between x1 and x4. Okay, so these variables are introduced to introduce correlations between the variables. And also the reason why this is called restricted Boltzmann machine, the name restricted comes from the fact that there are no connections between the hidden variables and the visible variables. So those are non-existent. We only introduce correlations between the visible variables and the hidden variables. Okay. Yeah, does that clarify your comment, Lauren?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Yeah, so I think since we're like at the end of the lecture, so I was willing to talk about like another approximate likelihood models, which are called autoencoders. So I also wanted to talk about the last classification of implicit likelihood models. So an example of these is the generative adversarial neural network. But like, since we don't have enough time, I will close the lecture